I'm Kimberly Atkins Store, and this is Justice by Design. So it has been quite a week or so for everyone, for a nation. An election was held after a, I guess, viciously battled election season, I guess is one way to put it. And it's certainly one that was driven by more than just partisan divides. And now we are still a nation. We have to find a way to move forward. And that may seem like a big order. But one place that I like to take solace in is the knowledge that history has a lot to teach us. And I frequently turn to it in trying to figure out what to learn about the moment that we're in. And so this week, to help me do that, I am so honored to be joined by a historian, Lindsay Travinsky. Lindsay, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm so looking forward to chatting with you.
So before we get started in our chat, tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
So I am the executive director of the George Washington Presidential Library at Mount Vernon. I'm a presidential historian. And I'm the author of a couple of books, the most recently being Making the Presidency, John Adams and the Presidents That Forged the Republic.
And I one of the things I love so much about you is I've heard you speak wonderfully about the Adams Presidential Historic Site. I used to live in Quincy, Massachusetts. And I used to walk there and just love on that place. And it's just like, have you guys ever been to, you know, saying to my friends and stuff? And I know it's a place that you also geek out about. So, you know, that's how I knew that we were meant to be. We were meant to be buddies.
Yes. Well, I think, you know, I think historic sites are so helpful because they help us to see people from the past in 3D. And oftentimes when we just read about them, even if we have really great imaginations, it can be hard to fully understand how they lived. And so space really gives us a sense of like, what were they seeing on a day-to-day basis? What were their views from their window? What sense did they experience? And Adams Presidential Site is such a great example because they had wisteria out the front door. So you know that like they were smelling wisteria. But really, if we're being honest, the diamond of the site is the library in which, you know, library dreams are made of.
It really, really is a great place. I encourage all my friends in Massachusetts and who are visiting to check it out if you haven't already. So, Lindsay, when I asked you to join me this week, it was before we knew the results of the election, but I knew I had this idea that we would talk about how a nation comes together after such a bitterly fought election cycle where people on whatever people's views were, they tended to be a lot stronger, I think, than a lot of other presidential elections. So afterwards, I was wondering, is this still the right question to ask? As a nation, how do we come together? Have we ever been together? Am I asking the wrong question? I guess I'll ask it this way. What in this moment can history teach us about the moment that we're in after an election, before a new administration takes place, when Americans are just trying to figure out where we are?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I was giving it a lot of thought. And I think your question about like, have we ever been together is a really good one. You know, I think this moment is useful for us to reflect on history in that there have been moments where we've been very intensely divided. There have been moments when elections were very intensely felt and intensely fought. And so on one hand, that to me is quite comforting that we've been in that place and that there are elements of this current existence that are very much precedented and that the nation has survived and endured and has continued to evolve. And so that to me is I think a good thing. And especially if we can look at, okay, how did we get through those moments? I'm not even going to necessarily say come together in those moments, but rather endure through them. But I do think there is something in the fact that there's probably never really been a moment when everyone was on the same page. There have been moments when we've come close, but usually they involve a foreign enemy that we can rally together to fight. So I think the closest we get are moments like World War II, where most Americans are on board with fighting against the Nazi threat in Europe and the Japanese imperial threat in the Pacific. But even then, we know that there were Americans who were very supportive of Germany and who believed that the Nazi way was the right one and that democracy didn't work. And so perhaps the lesson to take there is, how can we be a functional nation that continues to improve while acknowledging that we're never going to get everybody to agree with us?
Yeah, you know, I can even in my lifetime, even I think of after 9/11, for example, and with the subsequent initial invasion in Afghanistan, how, you know, whether you were a defense hawk or, you know, somebody who wanted to prioritize diplomatic, everybody seemed to say, this is the moment. And there was a unification. You know, I remember even for myself, I was not a big fan, for example, of George W. Bush. But when he stood on Ground Zero and spoke in the megaphone, I felt moved as an American. And there was that. But this doesn't feel like that. This feels very differently. And I think about how previous efforts to try to stitch together after a cleaving of our union didn't always work, you know, Reconstruction being, I think, the most obvious example. So what do you say to that? Is it too much to expect, sort of, you know, another way to ask my first question is it too much to expect that after something that divides us internally, that the road back from that is anything but hard?
Well, the road's going to be hard. I don't think there's any way to expect it to be easy. That doesn't mean it's not worth doing or that it's not possible, of course. And so I don't ever want to make people feel that there is no hope or that apathy is the answer, because that's actually the goal of some nefarious forces currently at play. They want you to not care. And so that should never be the outcome. You know, I love that you brought up Reconstruction, because that's been on my mind a lot too. And often that's because people talk about the Civil War and as this moment where the nation was most dramatically cleaved apart. And then they brought it back together. And so, but how did you bring it back together? And the way that most people were able to come back together, really is what I mean, is most white people, is because they focused on a shared history. And this is when you start to see the rise of like celebration of the cult of the founders, because you could have a shared history that you all agreed upon. You didn't have to focus on the recent history, because you could look at the shared history that everyone agreed was good and valiant and focus on that and move forward. And in doing so, they, of course, erased the experience of many working class Americans, Black Americans, enslaved Americans, and ignored the rise of Jim Crow. So that's obviously not the solution we're looking for at this moment. That is not the type of coming together that I think anyone desires. But I think there is a grain of helpfulness in that, which is the moments where we have been divided, but it's been less cataclysmic. So I think about politics when I first sort of started to become aware of politics. People disagreed on policy. They disagreed on tax policy, and they disagreed on, you know, to what extent you should fight against Russia and things like that. But by and large, I think there was a shared set of values about what the United States was supposed to be, and there was a disagreement about how to best get to them. So that's how you could have a disagreement about tax policy or what the best type of immigration reform looked like. That obviously also required a shared set of facts and a shared set of truths such that you could have a basis for that conversation. So to me, those are the things we should be looking for. A, how to have a shared set of facts that we can start a rational conversation on top of.
Yeah.
And B, how do we then sort of set what are our values as Americans such that we can acknowledge just, you know, differences of opinions about how to pursue those things, but how do we cultivate the values? Those are, I think, should be our goals.
So I want to dive deeper in that, but I want to reverse the order of that and talk about values first and the shared facts later, because I do want to talk a little bit about media and what history has taught us about what the media is doing. But I want to start by talking about our leaders, okay? So there's a discussion about what our leaders now, including the incoming administration, what they can do and what the impact of what they do on how we move forward as a country. And then there's also the electorate, the citizens, the people, and what they do. And I want to start with the leaders first. I know you talk about civic virtue, you know, the civic virtue of leaders, particularly presidents in this time, and the struggle to work with opposition, because that's an essential part of the job, and what that means. As we begin what won't be a lot of opposition here in Washington, where I am, it looks like it's going to be a pretty a one-party control over the branches of government from here. But there are still people who have different beliefs, and they've been through this election where one party was given the majority of the power. So what does history teach us about the challenges there?
Those are some big questions.
Yes. <They are. laughs> I wondered if you would regret coming on the show this week.
No, not at all. It actually, like, talking through these things with people like you, it actually really helps me sort of digest what I'm thinking and how I want to, you know, move forward and be helpful. You know, so there have been moments where we've seen really big swings, and there have been moments where individual parties have had long-term dominance and have really been able to enforce their will. You know, there was a period of time where Republican control of Congress was pretty significant. It's one of the reasons Nancy Pelosi finally agreed to run for leadership when she did, because she's like, I was just so tired of losing all the time. So that is not unusual. And I think history tells us that even if you do not have the majority, you still do have some influence. So especially in the Senate, as long as the filibuster still exists, and that is a big if, because I think there will be calls for the Republican Party to blow it up. But while it still exists, the Democratic senators do still have influence there. I think there are still Republican senators, certainly. While I don't want to necessarily place too many hopes on people like Collins and Murkowski, they still do have to answer to their constituents and have proven to at least have open ears to conversations. So I don't think we should write the entire thing off. We know that the House, based on history, can change really fast, because especially if it's a very razor thin majority, then people are going to be pulled into positions. People are going to be sick. Things happen. So we should never write off the possibility of having influence and working on those things. Where I think history tells us we should go is we have to stay focused, that the Democratic Party needs to be focused on a couple of things. If they get super distracted about all of the outrage all the time, they're going to dilute their ability to move a message and dilute their ability to influence a vote. So there are going to be a lot of things that the president-elect says that people find outrageous. I personally am less interested in rhetoric and more interested in policy and perhaps even individuals in positions, because those are the things that I think really are important and matter. So the Democratic Party, if it has any hope of coming back, needs to be very focused. It needs to be very disciplined. And it needs to choose a couple of things to fight on and let everything else go. Not that they are okay with it. You're not accepting it. You're not kowtowing to it. But you're recognizing that if you have limited authority, you have to use it effectively. I think that is an important message.
One thing I think is going to be particularly true. Now, I'm a lawyer, not a historian, but I've been thinking a lot since the election about the Constitution and about things like separation of powers and constitutional limits. And these are a lot of things that I think I can say on a factual basis that Donald Trump has not shown a lot of respect or regard for. One small case in point is, very soon after the election results, he said he wanted recess appointments, which means appointing people to his cabinet without the advice and consent of the Senate. It is a constitutional rule that allows that, which I believe was meant for emergency situations where you needed to get someone in the office quickly. It was not meant to be a substitute for the constitutional standard of advise and consent. That's just one tiny thing. He said he wanted to be a dictator on, you know, day one. A lot of things. What does history teach us about the guardrails to our democracy and whether they can hold even with a leader who does not take the rule of law as seriously as I do deep in my heart?
So pros and cons. So the pros are that no president does everything that they say they're going to do. They're just not able to achieve it. And sometimes that's because the courts strike it down. Sometimes that's because there are impediments in Congress. Sometimes it's because they've, you know, spent all their political capital. So that doesn't mean we shouldn't take people at their word. I generally believe that we should take candidates and president-elect or, you know, senators-elect at their word. It's generally a good idea, but it is safe to assume that they will not be able to achieve 100% of what they ran on just because that's not how politics works. So that's the pro. The con is that our system actually really depends on the honor system. It really depends on people acting in good faith and genuinely trying to do the right thing most of the time. There are checks and balances. There are things that have been put in place to try and hold people accountable, but a lot of the laws are sort of toothless on their enforcement. I know you've talked about like the Hatch Act, for example. Yeah. The Hatch Act is such a lovely concept, it is so terribly poor at actually enforcing certain behavior. And there are a lot of examples like that, that are really well-intentioned, but the courts or internal structures have not proven adequate to actually enforcing that behavior. This is true from sort of the base level, although I think generally, they're actually better enforcing at people lower down that don't have as much institutional authority. It is especially true for the president because even to this day, despite the fact that we have so many more statutes and so many more laws than we did in 1787 when the Constitution was written, much of the presidency is still not written down. Much of the presidency is built on norm and custom, which is basically just another way of saying expectation. And if a president defies those expectations, public shame and elections and impeachment are really the only tools to combat those things. We've already seen that impeachment does not work as a mechanism force. There will not be another election for 4 years. And thus far, President-elect Trump has proven fairly immune to public shame on most things, not all, but on most things.
Yeah.
So that means that there's just not a whole lot of institutional buildup there that will keep people within a certain realm of behavior.
And so I'm just thinking, you know, constitutionally, and you can help lead us through it historically, you're talking about these checks and balances, what's built into the Constitution, a lot of things, but among those on the president is you have his cabinet, which very luckily you've written a book about presidential cabinet, and the Supreme Court. So far, from what we've seen, the announcements from President-elect Trump, which of course it's not official until after January 20th when he is sworn in and is able to make these nominations. But so far he's signaling his closest of close allies in key positions, including as of the time of this taping, Congressman Matt Gaetz as Attorney General, someone who is not only a Trump loyalist, but someone who himself has been the subject of a criminal investigation involving very serious charges. What does this tell us already about cabinets? I mean, this is not the team of rivals that Lincoln assembled. What does this tell you as a historian so far about what Trump is looking for, whether these specific folks end up being nominees or not?
So I have two takeaways. One is that in some ways, Trump has been highly consistent. He's been highly consistent with what he promised to do, which is surround himself with people who would not push back. He was very clear on the campaign trail that he learned his lesson and that he wanted people who were loyal to him and would do things that he wanted. And I think we have largely seen appointments that reflect that promise and that intention. He has also diverged from both his first term example, in which he did have more institutionalists around him, but also most other presidents that are looking to bring together different factions of the American people, different types of Americans, to have a better understanding of different perspectives. the best presidents recognize that they don't have all the answers, and they're never going to have all the answers because no one person can. And so they surround themselves with people with different areas of expertise and knowledge to make them better and to tell them when they're wrong. That piece is really critical. The best presidents don't want to be surrounded by yes men because they know that that will make them better. And so from what I've seen thus far, Trump is pulling from a fairly narrow, both like within the Republican Party, but also within the American people more broadly. I think Florida is represented in almost, I think, like half the positions thus far. But also there's not a whole lot of suggestion that there's anyone that's going to push back on any sort of idea.
Right. Right. So let's talk about the Supreme Court a little bit. We know that the Supreme Court operates under the rule of law. That's the force that it has. And even in some very unpopular rulings that were made in real time, such as Brown v. Board of Education, folks forget that that was not popular when it happened. The force of that ruling alone wasn't enough. It required the executive branch under the president to send in the National Guard to enforce and allow Black people to go to school in those southern states. If the Supreme Court tries, I'm not saying that it will, and we'll have more of a discussion about what the Supreme Court will do, listeners, on Sisters-in-Law, hashtag Sisters-in-Law. So listen to that podcast this week. We don't have time to get into that right now. But, you know, as Trump is putting his administration together, his cabinet members staffing the executive branch, it doesn't sound like he's really excited to stack it with people who will put teeth to orders to the U.S. Supreme Court. So on the one hand, this is Trump's court. He helped to build it. He helped to build this conservative majority. But on the other hand, how much power does this court have to even try to be accountable? Is this a much weaker court from what we know from history, from clashes with the president and the court under Trump, as opposed to a stronger one?
This is such an interesting question. So, you know, especially because this court has been quite jealous of its own authority and has been very quick to claw back authority from Congress or to create authority on its behalf from Congress and from the executive, especially executive agencies. And yet, as I know you have often said, it forgets that it doesn't really have an army, and it depends very much on public opinion and goodwill and a willingness to go along with what it says. And at times, as you said, executive force to actually make it happen. So it's a very interesting hypothetical, and one that I admit that I hope we don't get to, because I don't totally know what would happen if we were to pit the presidency against the Supreme Court. And this court, despite its immunity ruling, which I do want to circle back to, at times was willing to check President Trump during his first term. And so I am honestly not sure what would happen, because I think that Trump has said, you know, they're his justices. It's his court. He expects them to fall in line and to give him what he wants. I don't think they see themselves that way. And so I suspect that they would not permit that, or they would not give him just an order that he wants just because he wants it. But that would absolutely set up a constitutional crisis. And I'm not sure we've seen one like that. I think we got pretty close with Andrew Jackson when he basically was saying, you know, let them enforce it. Yes. But that, you know, again, Andrew Jackson is not the model that you want to follow, just like the Civil War is not the model you want to follow when you're thinking about historic parallels.
But that's what, I mean, J.D. Vance literally cited and quoted that on the campaign trail. So it seems that this is the model that this incoming administration wants to follow, right?
It seems so. I think that would be an interesting question, because a lot of the what we think of as the Republican institutionalists, and I don't mean like old school, you know, George H.W. Bush institutionalists. I mean like the Federalist Society and people who are invested in the Republican project today are invested in the court system. And so it would really challenge their loyalties to have a split in that particular fashion. And so I don't know who would blink first in that instance.
That's
historians are very bad future predictors, so I will not try.
I've gotten out of that business too, so I understand. I understand that. You said you wanted to circle back to the immunity decision,
yeah.
And I wanted to give you a chance to do that because I've also been thinking a lot about that and how that fundamentally changes the office and the powers of the presidency.
It does, you know, and I am not a lawyer, and I do not play one on television, and so I come at it really from a historical perspective. And the biggest takeaway that I have is, you know, generally when people say the founders thought that, that's a red flag that whatever they say next is a load of crock, because the founders very rarely agreed on anything,
right?
With maybe one exception, which is that there was not to be a king. That the president was supposed to be accountable to the rule of law. Once the president left office, they were a citizen just like anyone else. The whole point of the revolution is that the king could not be held accountable for his actions. And so the purpose of a new government was to have the humans in the positions accountable. And so, however, it will change the presidency, and I think it will change the presidency a great deal. I'm not sure in exactly what that will look like, but I can say that the decision is the antithesis of original intent, which is ironic given the position often articulated by the justices.
So I want to end this discussion because I have 1,000 more questions, but we are limited by time, by talking about the American people and how it gets its information, which brings us to my industry. I have been very critical in the way that some media organizations and some journalists covered the election. But I also admit that that's not the only issue. We get our information so differently than we did when I grew up. There is not a single Tom Brokaw speaking to all of us through our televisions. It's compartmentalized. It is individualized through social media. It's gotten full of misinformation. Add AI on top of that. And it really, really showed how where Americans are, even given polling and everything else, can be so different than we might think it is because we're in our own little media silos. Has that ever happened before in history? And how might that affect the way we as a nation, as a people, move forward?
It absolutely has. And this is actually, I think, quite instructive. So anytime there has been a technological innovation that has changed how humans consume news, whether it was the printing press or the expansion of newspapers or the telegraph or radio or television, we as humans have freaked out because it is a whole new way of getting information and news, and it causes incredible disruption to society, whether it be sort of the hierarchical norms, who are the trusted sources, who's responsible for that, how we consume it. So that sort of disruption has occurred every single time. And it takes us a while to sort of sort through it. But a good parallel, I think, is the 1790s, in which the primary form of news and exchange of information was letters that people wrote themselves and then exchanged and passed around, and newspapers. Newspapers at the time were highly partisan. There were a couple that were sort of straight down the middle that had generally the government contracts for printing of bills and things like that. But most were highly partisan. There were the Federalist newspapers. There were the Democratic Republican newspapers. The difference is that everyone knew they were partisan. So everyone knew that you were reading a Federalist newspaper or a Republican newspaper. There was not an expectation that just because you were a newspaper editor, you were acting in good faith. Mm. I think the problem is that we still have a lot of people that are operating under an expectation of journalistic ethos that really didn't actually emerge until the 1890s with the rise of muckrake journalism that was around the Progressive Era and sort of helped uncover abuses in labor and housing and food quality and started the concept that to be a journalist was to pursue truth, to hold power to account, and was a career to aspire to. So there's a whole generation, I think, of people who are operating under the expectation that there is a Tom Brokaw, as you said, or a Walter Cronkite that want to tell them the truth. And they don't realize that there are a lot of people who are just lying, and they're lying for partisan value or for partisan benefit and on purpose. It's not that, I mean, some people are making mistakes, but some people are quite intentional. And so I think that the for me, the challenge is not so much to go back to having one shared set of news, because I don't think that that's ever going to be the outcome with our media ecosystem. It's a media literacy problem. Yeah. It's an understanding of what is trustworthy, what is safe, and even just being able to analyze someone's biases can be enormously helpful and can help us get back to a place where we can have productive conversations.
I really appreciate that. I really hope that one of the lessons that is learned out of this is the importance of media literacy. I don't believe, when I've spoken to people leading up to the election who were strong Trump supporters, strong Harris supporters, and everywhere in between, there were at least some instances where I could hear them say something that I knew as a reporter in covering this not to be true. But when I told them about it, almost to a person, with very few exceptions, they said, oh, you know what? I didn't realize that. Thanks for letting me know. I thought that this thing was true. And I think that made me agree with you, is that if we knew, if we taught people how, not just that we should be skeptical of news sources and try to have a diverse set of sources from which we get our news, it doesn't ring true until a situation like that where they realize, oh, I was actually factually misled. Thank you for that. I'm looking to get this information. It's not everybody. It doesn't relieve our own natural confirmation biases as something that all humans do. But I do think that people don't know who to trust or how to figure out who to trust it. And I think that is a learned skill. And I think that that is something that I wish we could. That is something I wish we could solve in this podcast. I wish we could solve in this nation. but in the meantime, Lindsay, I am so grateful for you joining me today on Justice by Design to kick off this conversation, because I think just from what we've covered today, it's really important to identify all the work that needs to be done and what history teaches us about it. So thank you for joining me.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for having these conversations. I do think that we have to be thinking these big, hard things, and it doesn't mean that they're fun, but we have to start somewhere, and usually having the conversation is a good place.
I agree. You know, I know here on Justice by Design, it's all about finding the solutions, you know, to some of the problems. Even if they're small, there are things that can be models that can be replicated. There aren't a lot of solutions in today's episode, but I think that that's okay. I think sometimes it's really important to regroup, look to history, look to what we know, look to where we've been, to have a clear-eyed view of what lies ahead, to be ready for what might come. And we may not know all the answers at one point. That happens a lot of the time. But I think the clearer we can be about where we've been and where we are, the better we can be at protecting the principles and values we care about and finding the way forward. So I thank Lindsay today for helping us do that. And I thank you for joining me this week for Justice by Design. Don't forget to follow the podcast wherever you listen. Tell friends about it. We're still relatively new and trying to grow. And definitely give 5 stars, because that helps other people find the podcast too. I'll be back next week with another episode. Take care.
Georgia.
Hi, David. What do you think the world needs more of?
Well, the world always needs more podcasts.
Didn't you used to have a podcast?
Not only did I used to have a podcast, Georgia, it's coming back. David Tennant Does a Podcast With, season 3 is coming at you.
Okay, and who are your guests?
Who are my guests? What about Russell T Davis? What about Jamila Jamil? What about Stanley the Tooch Tucci?
So it's really just you hanging out with your mates then?
Yeah.
Come, join me. David Tennant Does a Podcast With. Bye.